and local. Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, we're keeping you connected this election season. The ACLU asks the U.S. Supreme Court to take up a challenge to Pennsylvania's mail ballot dating rule. The federal case is separate from an ongoing litigation in the state Supreme Court, and it's unlikely to be resolved before November. We chat with Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA for the latest election litigation in this crucial swing state. The science of fall colors. For years, scientists have worked to understand the changes that occur in trees and shrubs during autumn. Joe Johnson, our resident science guy, is here to explain the basics to help you enjoy nature's multicolored display. Plus, a special Moving Toward Health segment with Maggie Fitzpatrick. In addition to her weekly health and fitness advice, she's got a special guest today, the author of the Bulgarian Training Manual. Uh-oh.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A U.S. senior official has told NPR that Iran is preparing to launch a ballistic strike on Israel. Separately, an official in the Middle East speaking anonymously in line with protocol tells NPR Iran is poised to launch an attack on Israel immediately. This comes as Israel has moved ground forces into southern Lebanon in a significant escalation of its battle with Hezbollah. As NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports, Lebanese politicians are urgently calling on the international community to pressure Israel to stop its military advance.
Israel says it's running a, quote, limited incursion of targeted ground raids in southern Lebanon. But Lebanese Member of Parliament Najat Aoun Saliba says foreign governments should be clear. This, she says, is an invasion.
And we have to call on the international community to call it as such and act accordingly.
More than 1 million people have been forced to flee their homes in the Israeli strikes on Lebanon. The United Nations has launched an appeal for $425 million in humanitarian aid. And Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Meati has warned that Lebanon is going through, quote, one of the most dangerous moments in its history. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
What was Hurricane Helene has now killed at least 130 people across the southeastern U.S. Forecasters warn there are still 2 months left in the Atlantic hurricane season. NPR's Michael Copley reports on how to stay safe if you are cleaning up from a flood.
The first thing is to make sure it's safe to go back inside your house. If it is and there's no standing water, turn off the electricity at the breaker box. Then check how high the water rose. If it got above the electrical sockets, call an electrician. After that, you'll want to take as many pictures as possible to show the damage. That's important for filing an insurance claim or applying for federal aid. Then you need to dry things out as fast as possible. Rip up carpets, remove furniture, and cut out drywall starting a foot above the waterline. Michael Copley, NPR News.
Stocks open lower this morning as cargo traffic comes to a halt at ports along the East Coast and Gulf Coast. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 285 points in early trading.
Tens of thousands of longshoremen went on strike just after midnight at ports stretching from Boston to Houston. Those ports handle more than half the shipping containers moving cargo in and out of the country. While businesses have tried to stockpile goods in anticipation of the walkout, a prolonged strike could be costly. Dock workers are seeking higher pay and stricter limits on automation. Inflation in the eurozone has dipped below 2% for the first time in more than 3 years. That could prompt the European Central Bank to be more aggressive in cutting interest rates. Here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve also began cutting rates last month, but Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said yesterday he and his colleagues are in no hurry. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. The vice presidential candidates will meet on a stage tonight in New York for their only scheduled debate this election season. Ohio Republican Senator J.D. Vance and Democratic Minnesota Governor Tim Walz won't have an audience as they debate. CBS, which is holding the event, says they are not allowed to use pre-written notes or prompts. The Biden administration is touting another win for the Inflation Reduction Act, its financial relief for Medicare beneficiaries who are taking certain drugs administered in the hospital. NPR's Sidney Lupkin explains.
When drug companies increase list prices faster than inflation, federal law now means they have a price to pay, bigger rebates for Medicare Part B. As for patients, they get a break from expensive coinsurance on these drugs. Instead of paying 20%, they will pay less. Often the new coinsurance is 19%, so the savings can be modest, a few dollars. But for a handful of very expensive drugs, patients could save more than $1,000 on their coinsurance. That's for drugs like Kymriah for blood cancers and Breyanzi for lymphomas. The savings could be especially helpful for people who don't have supplemental Medicare coverage. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
NATO has a new leader. The longtime Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has officially turned over leadership to the former Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte. The new NATO leader says that his priorities for the Western military alliance include support for Ukraine against Russia. Rutte also says that he wants to increase defense spending and improve NATO's global partnerships. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're keeping you connected this election season. The American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to decide whether requiring voters to date their mail ballot return envelopes violates federal law. The group filed its petition Friday on behalf of the Pennsylvania branch of the NAACP. It follows a separate request from voting rights groups to Pennsylvania's highest court for an expedited ruling on that date requirement. The case is one of several challenging the rules around mail ballot voting in Pennsylvania and centers on whether the state's requirement that voters handwrite a date on their mail ballot return envelope violates the materiality provision of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Jason Dole spoke to Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA for the latest.
As you know, Pennsylvania law right now, it requires that voters sign and date their mail ballot return envelope in order for their ballot to be counted. And that dating part has been disputed for years in and out of the courts. Courts have said it's not necessary based on federal law. Courts have said it is necessary. It's been challenged under the state constitution. And so where we're at with it right now is that there was a case brought by the ACLU after the primary challenging the dating requirement. They were successful in eliminating it in the state's Commonwealth Court, but the Supreme Court struck that down. And then just this past week now, the ACLU has asked the state Supreme Court if they would retake the issue and skip the lower court process that most court cases normally go through a special power that the Supreme Court has called King's Bench Authority. And that might be a little bit contradictory because I just said that the Supreme Court had knocked down the case, but they shot it down on procedural grounds, saying that the lower court didn't have the authority to take up the issue. So now the ACLU is saying, well, hey, you have this authority to take up the issue, so we'd like it if you do so.
And in fact, that idea was brought up by one of the members of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court when they made that ruling. I think that was on the 20th or so. Is that correct? That they even suggested that themselves, or at least one of the members did.
That's right. The ruling that dismissed the case on jurisdictional grounds, that was a 4-3 ruling. And the three dissenting judges, they wrote in their dissent, they disagreed with shooting it down on jurisdictional grounds, but they also said if we're going to do that, we should take it up on our King's Bench authority because this is an important issue. So the Supreme Court hasn't yet said whether it's going to take the case using that authority, but you know, the fact that three out of the seven judges have already said that they think they should use that authority to take the case, that's a pretty good sign that they would.
So, again, the ACLU has now officially asked them to use this King's Bench power?
That's right. Yeah, they have. And I think you referenced another Supreme Court case in your intro that they had to talk about.
Yeah. So the ACLU, is this the same ACLU that brought this original case about the ballots in Pennsylvania? Are they the same ones now going to the U.S. Supreme Court?
It is, yeah. And you might remember, and your listeners might remember, several months ago at this point, when we were talking about mail ballot dating lawsuits, we were primarily talking about challenges in the federal court under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That was the case that had been going on since 2022. And just before the primary here in March, the primary is in April, but in March, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a decision from a lower court that said that the ballots didn't need to be dated on their return envelope. That one kind of languished at that Third Circuit level for several months because the ACLU had a long time in which they could appeal it up to the U.S. Supreme Court if they wanted. And it seems like the strategy is they didn't want to appeal it up to the U.S. Supreme Court while they had this state Supreme Court challenge in the works that could maybe work. But their deadline to appeal was this past Friday, and they did appeal up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And, you know, that court, we don't know if it's going to take it as well. But just another sign that this issue is not one that's going to be going away.
Yeah, and it's also not one that necessarily will be resolved before Election Day because, I mean, you're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. That's a different time frame there.
Definitely. If the U.S. Supreme Court takes it up, that one is a much longer shot than the state Supreme Court challenge in the first place, but also either way it would shake out. Not going to happen before the election. The state Supreme Court challenge, now that might happen before the election because when they take these cases under their King's Bench authority, you know, kind of the whole pretext to that is, hey, this is something that is very important that needs to be resolved quickly, so we can't go through the normal court process. So if they were to take it up, that one we probably would see a decision before November. And, you know, just to reiterate why all this back and forth between the courts and the parties is important, you know, this really does affect a lot of voters here in Pennsylvania. According to my look at the state's data from this primary, there were about 8,500 ballots rejected in Pennsylvania for errors that voters make, like forgetting a signature or a date or not putting their ballot in a secrecy envelope. And of those 8,500, about 4,400 of them were for these dating issues. So it can impact a large number of ballots, and that's going to be exponentially higher now in the general election when we have a lot more people voting.
Just staying with that, I want to say staying with the mail ballot issue, but there are multiple cases now just about Pennsylvania's mail ballot. Staying with the dating case at the state level, is there any indication, you say it may happen before Election Day, is there any indication, any way of you knowing anything about when they might take it up? What are the signs that would indicate that the state Supreme Court will use that King's Bench power?
Yeah, well, basically, the answer is you just got to stay glued to the court's docket, which I'm looking at right now. When they decide that they're taking it, they will issue some kind of order about briefing schedules or whatnot. They haven't done that yet. It wasn't under a King's Bench authority, but it was a different case related to mail ballots that somebody was asking the Supreme Court to take through the normal case taking process. That took a couple weeks for them to issue an order saying, okay, yeah, we'll take it. So there really is no way to tell. I expect once they do take it, though, if and when they do take it, it would move quickly.
Okay, now moving up to the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania, the case that they're taking to the U.S. Supreme Court about this dating ballot return, whether that violates federal law. You mentioned that the group filed its petition on Friday on behalf of the Pennsylvania branch of the NAACP, and you quote Jeanette Wallace, general counsel of the NAACP, and I just want to share his quote with listeners saying, quote, "The right to vote is one of the most important in this country. Ballots should not be rejected because of irrelevant errors. We will continue to fight so that the voters' voices may be heard." And that's a quote, again, from Jeanette Wallace, general counsel of the NAACP. I'm wondering, can you tell me any more about the viewpoints of those that are working on this, that it's the ACLU that is actually asking the Supreme Court to do things, whether doing it on behalf of the NAACP? Are there any other parties involved, any other folks weighing in like that?
Yeah, I mean, the case that in the state case, there's a coalition of voting rights groups. Let me just read you some of the names here. There's the New Pennsylvania Project Education Fund, which you can think of as similar to the New Georgia Project. The NAACP is part of that case as well. Common Cause, which has branches all over the country, the Black Political Empowerment Project. So there are a lot of organizations that have been pushing against this data requirement for years. And I should say not just the organizations themselves, but also election administrators. They don't typically argue for political purposes. In fact, they don't do that ever. But they have for years been saying this data isn't really – it's not a value to us for how we do our jobs. It doesn't make a difference to how we administer the election because we already know when we sent out the ballots and when we received them back. And that's kind of what Mr. Wallace is getting at here in his quote, is that this requirement, they see it as superfluous and just an unnecessary burden for their voters.
Is it really just a matter of how the initial law was written, that was just written in the law, and so now that's the way it needs to be?
Yes, basically that's what happened. My understanding has been that, you know, when I wasn't covering elections at the time that Act 77, which is this law, came into place, but my understanding in the years since has really been that they just took the language from our absentee ballot voting statute, which was, it still exists, but it was an older provision where people, if they're not going to be in their polling place on election day or they're sick, they could use that as an excuse and vote by mail that way. They just took the language from that law and copied and pasted it over to the mail voting law. But the absentee ballot voting statutes, they were written at a time before we had these electronic systems that could timestamp and track when the ballots were sent out and received back. So that information was necessary. It was necessary for voters to write it on the return envelope so that they knew it had been received in time for the election, because it has to be received by the end of voting on election day, 8 p.m. But now we have electronic systems that are tracking all that.
How are you feeling about the strength of this, I don't know if you call it a case or petition, to the U.S. Supreme Court, especially since, as you mentioned, that the third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals already ruled in March that the requirement did not violate a federal provision. So what's the likelihood that case has some legs?
Yeah. Well, I think it's always a little bit of a fool's errand to try and predict what any court will do, especially the Supreme Court. They've had some surprises on voting rights cases in the last couple of years. People were expecting them to rule one way, but then they ruled another. But I'll say the Third Circuit Court of Appeals opinion, if I'm remembering correctly, it was a three-judge panel, and two of them were Democratic appointees. And this issue had partially come to the U.S. Supreme Court before, this dating issue, just in a real minor way. And Judge Clarence Thomas had in the writing that he had that basically said this case is no longer an issue, he seemed to display some skepticism towards this argument that the ACLU is trying to put forward before the court now. So those two things wouldn't really bode well for them if the court does take up this case.
Okay, I hate to ask because we've got mired here in just talking just about two different Supreme Courts dealing with a very similar case, but I'm going to ask you, what other cases are you watching that might impact the election right now, and have there been any developments since the last time we talked?
Yeah, lots of cases, not as many developments this past week. I guess you know, two appeals to the Supreme Court is not enough for one week, but the other ones have been a little bit more stagnant. You know, there's a case we've talked about out of Western PA about whether, if a county is going to reject a voter's ballots for one of those three reasons I mentioned, if they have to notify the voter, that is also has been appealed up to the Supreme Court, waiting to hear if they're going to take it. There's another case from Western PA on if a voter's ballot gets rejected, can they go cast a provisional ballot and have that counted? Supreme Court has accepted that case, and just waiting on the decision there. And then, of course, there's another big one, which is a Republican case using the same legal argument as the mail ballot dating case. It's asking the Supreme Court to use its King's Bench authority to determine whether or not counties should be able to allow voters to fix those errors on their mail ballot. Like a voter doesn't put on a date, can the county call up that voter, say, hey, you didn't put on a date, you need to come down to the office and put a date on your envelope, or we're going to reject your ballot. The Republicans, RNC and PA GOP, are arguing, you know, that's illegal under Pennsylvania law, and Supreme Court, we'd like you to stop that practice around the state. Supreme Court hasn't ruled yet if they're going to take that case. But if they do, that's another one that could have a big impact.
Does any of this have the potential to affect how the votes are counted on election night or immediately afterwards? Because I know that Pennsylvania boards of elections already have their work cut out for them doing all their counting on election night. Is any of this potentially impacting this beyond whether or not they know which votes get counted or not?
Well, I think as of right now, it's an unknown. Election managers don't really know what they'll be doing. Are they going to count these ballots? Can they call their voters if they have a mistake to be made? But I'll say, the Department of State and the counties have really been pushing courts in the past couple of years to kind of get more on board with the election calendar. There's been a number of times where courts have released decisions in the midst of an election. And, you know, some of that they can't help. But there have been other times when, you know, the decision probably could have waited a week or so to align better with the election calendar, so it wouldn't seem like it was changing the rules right in the middle of things. And so the Department of State and counties have really been pushing the courts to avoid issuing those kinds of decisions. And that's why we've been seeing these Supreme Court cases move so quickly, because the court instituted some new rules that would tighten up these deadlines to try and move this stuff along quicker. So it seems like to me the court has gotten the message that, hey, we don't want to be appearing to or actually changing the rules in the middle of an election, especially not a presidential election. So I'm hoping we're not going to see any of the stuff that we saw maybe in 2022 that would have changed the rules a bit for how these ballots got counted. But again, we're just going to have to wait and see how these cases play out and if there's any other cases that get brought up between now and then.
This is a large state. There's a lot of people that are affected by these things. And then on top of that, you have the added pressure, the fact that it's a swing state. And, you know, the whole country is kind of watching what happens in Pennsylvania very closely. I mean, you're reporting on it at a state level, but like the whole country's watching it. I mean, writing for a national audience this weekend, the New York Times put out an article called 5 Court Cases to Watch Ahead of Election Day. And, you know, this ballot dating case is right there, front and center. What do you think about that just in terms of the story and what it means for this moment that, you know, the country is kind of watching this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the right take on it from the Times, that it seems like this election is coming down to Pennsylvania, right? And Pennsylvania in 2016 swung about, what, 44,000 votes for Trump, 88 in 2020 for Biden. That's you know, a space of like 100, 130,000 ballots. And since those races, some reporting we did 2 weeks ago, the state has gotten much closer in terms of how many Republicans and how many Democrats there are registered with each party. So there's even less wiggle room that we've had before. And before it was really tight, and polling is showing it's really tight. And so even though these, I don't want to say a couple thousand voters as if, you know, one person who's eligible to vote not being able to vote isn't a problem. Of course, we want everybody who's eligible to vote to vote. But that's why we're seeing such a focus on these issues that might only affect a couple of thousand voters. Because, you know, a couple thousand here, a couple thousand there, that could add up and have an impact on the results.
All right. Well, Carter, I want to thank you for going over all of this. Is there anything that you didn't get to that you want folks to know before we go?
I would just say again, a reminder that Pennsylvania does not have the ability to start processing its mail ballots before Election Day, and that is likely going to cause a delay in our results. So we won't know how the state votes. In all likelihood, we won't know on election night.
That's Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA speaking to our own Jason Dole. And we're keeping you connected with the election. Our election coverage continues tonight as we bring you NPR's live special coverage of the CBS News vice presidential debate simulcast. That's tonight at 9:00. And later this week, our local candidate interviews continue. We'll hear from Michelle Frazier, the Democrat, challenging Republican incumbent Peter Oberrocker for the 51st State Senate District in New York. We'll take a break now, and when we come back, Science Stories with Joe Johnson. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjayville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Matt Hurtado. Join me on a journey where pixels meet melodies and controllers become conductors. This is Virtual Soundscapes, the show that transports you to the sonic realms of video game magic. In this journey, we'll uncover the hidden treasures of video game soundtracks from the classics to modern day and speak with industry veterans. Join me every Thursday night at 10 p.m. only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The leaves are changing throughout upstate New York and northeast Pennsylvania, and parts of the Catskills and Adirondacks are at the midpoint of fall foliage. But why do leaves change colors this time of year? Joe Johnson is our resident science guy, and he's here with the science of fall colors. But first, he'll tell us about a few other science stories that sparked his curiosity this week. He'll tell us about how archaeologists have discovered arrowheads that reveal the presence of a mysterious army in Europe's oldest battle, and fast radio bursts, one of which reached the Earth after 8 billion years.
This is a relatively newly discovered phenomenon. It was only first discovered in 2007. And what it is a fast radio burst, exactly what it sounds like. It's a few milliseconds long burst, but it's incredibly powerful radio waves, enough power that the sun would put out in 30 years is its original source, that much power. They last a few milliseconds long, and the vast majority of them are extragalactic in origin. In other words, they come from outside the Milky Way galaxy. They come from other galaxies. They are, as I said, powerfully, real, super powerful, and there's about 1,000 of them per day that we can detect. We estimate about 1,000 per day. We can't be watching the entire sky, but the little bit of the sky that we do see, we see enough to estimate, like I said, about 1,000 of them per day. They are very short. They last a few milliseconds. A millisecond is 1,000th of a second. And then they're gone. I heard some that they had slowed down and turned into audio, and they kind of sounded like whales. That was very interesting. The mystery for me, one of the cool mysteries about this is that about 10% of them are repeating. In other words, they repeat either sporadically, and there's one actually that repeats every 16.35 days. They don't know why.
We don't know why.
Yeah.
We don't know who or what.
Well,
might
I don't
be
think
sending
it's a,
these signals.
I don't think it's a who. I think it's a what. As I said, they were discovered in 2007 by scientists at West Virginia University. They were looking at six-year-old data. And the article that caught my interest, though, was about the most recent one that they discovered. It was FRB20220610A. And it traveled 8 billion years to get here. It came from a galaxy 8 billion light years away. Now, radio waves travel at the speed of light. And so if it's traveling from 8 billion years, light years away, it takes 8 billion years to get here, which is crazy. Just how powerful it must have been at its origin to still be going 8 billion years later that we can detect it.
How does this help us understand the universe more?
Well, I think it helps us to understand what we don't understand. They really are not sure what's causing them. There's several theories about their origin. Some of them involve collisions of neutron stars and collisions of black holes, and even some large supernova are occasionally trotted out as a possible explanation. I think the most popular theory, though, is magnetars. Now, a magnetar is a neutron star that's a very large neutron star, but it has a very strong magnetic field, so strong that if you got within 1,000 miles of it, it would tear you apart. That's how strong the magnetic field is. They think that this field becomes disrupted when there may be some kind of disturbance on the surface of the star. They even call them starquakes, and it disturbs the magnetic field and releases energy as a giant flare of radio waves. Now, in 2020, I said earlier that the vast majority of them are extragalactic. There have been a couple that have been discovered within our own galaxy. Back in 2020, they detected one about 30,000 light years away, which puts it in the Milky Way. And when they checked the source where it came from, it was a magnetar. So it's looking good that that might be possibly an explanation for it. The thing is, it's only one data point. It's only one observation. So we've got to do a lot more work on this. There's a couple of gigantic telescopes, the ASCAP in Australia and the CHIME telescope, which are specifically looking for these right now.
We may not be alone.
Yeah. They're in a totally different frequency and wavelength than normal radio signals.
Than Radio Catskill.
Yeah, than Radio Catskill.
All right, let's turn to an ancient European battleground.
Yeah, yeah.
There are some, 3,000-year-old arrowheads been discovered?
More than, yeah. This is in the Tallensa Valley, which is in what is now northeast Germany. It was an article in the Cambridge University Press, which was specifically about the arrowheads. But I got really interested in this story, and I kind of did a deep dive on this, and I read a whole bunch of articles on it. The original find happened in 1996 when an amateur, this is a little gruesome, found a human arm bone with a flint arrowhead embedded in it sticking out of a riverbank on the Tallensa River. When the archaeologists came to look at it and start looking at the area and start investigating, they found lots of materials, lots of things that looked like there was a very large violent conflict back in the 13th century BC. About 3,250 years ago is when they've pegged this thing. This was during the Bronze Age, when bronze was starting to replace stone tools. So it's kind of the end of the Stone Age and the beginning of Bronze Age. They found more than 20,000 human bones and bone fragments within or adjacent to the river. And in fact, a lot of the artifacts and the bones came up out of the river. They were dredged out of the river and the wetlands nearby. There's about 150 individuals that they have identified through their bones. They haven't identified them, but they've been able to say this is a separate person. Most of them are young males, and most of them show wounds that were incurred about the time of their death. So this was a really, really violent conflict. They found a whole bunch of weapons, clubs, knives, palstaves, which is a word I didn't know. It's a kind of axe, spearheads, and even a sword. The most numerous weapon they found, though, are the arrowheads. And they found, this is the interesting part, about 75% of them were the local flint arrowheads, but about 25% of them were non-local arrowheads. They think they came from the south. And they know this because of grave goods. When they would bury a warrior, they would bury him or her with weapons. And so they know what kind of arrowheads were used in what areas by looking at the grave goods. And so about 25% of the arrowheads they found in the area in this battle were from the south, were from down near what is now Bavaria and Moravia.
Does that give any indication as to who fought in the battle, then?
Well, it's so long ago, we really don't know. We have another piece of evidence, though. They do isotopic analysis of the bones and specifically the teeth, and they can tell where an individual was raised, where they grew up by the isotopic ratio, specifically strontium in the teeth. Different areas have different amounts of strontium and different ratios of the isotopes in their groundwater. And so as you grow up, that's incorporated into your teeth. And so they can get a good idea where you came from by the chemicals in your teeth. There were a lot of locals. They matched the local groundwater, but there were also a whole bunch. Like I said, it looks like they came from somewhere down in a southern part of Europe.
You mentioned the timing of this as the Bronze Age was starting. Is there any indication as to why this battle happened?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Was it a territorial battle? I mean, this is a fertile river valley. I did look at it on Google Earth, and it's just a beautiful area, nice little meandering river. Was this some sort of raid? They did find some high-value goods, like gold rings and bronze rings. They found some horse remains. And so they're not sure exactly why this battle took place. The main battle seems to have been at a shallow fording place in the river where you would cross the river. So we don't know. Was this a trading caravan? Was it a territorial dispute? Now, only a small portion of the area has been excavated, so there's going to have to be a lot more pits being dug and excavations happening here.
And we say every week that you bring us some science stories that caught your eye. This is something that's caught everyone's eye.
Yes,
it
has.
The leaves changing color.
Yeah, it's been beautiful.
It's been beautiful, but why? Why do the leaves change color in the fall, guy Joe Johnson?
the leaves and the color changing are changing in the fall are amazing. They're really beautiful, but they're very temporary. And so I don't want to take the magic out of this for people. So if you don't want to listen, you maybe turn to another station. No, don't do that.
Kids are listening, you
yes. might want to. Not all plants do turn. Only what they call deciduous trees, deciduous plants, trees, bushes, and shrubbery. Conifers stay green all winter long because they have different leaf structure. They're just a different type of plant. Now, the plant colors are primarily due to photosynthetic pigments. That's why they have the colors, is they trying to do photosynthesis. Now, we know that green color is due to the presence of
chlorophyll.
There you go. Very good. Yeah, chlorophyll is that chemical that allows the plant to carry on photosynthesis and convert carbon dioxide and water into glucose and oxygen. The thing about chlorophyll, though, is it's a very delicate molecule. It's a big molecule. It's got 55 carbons in it. It's a big structure. And it's actually so delicate that it breaks down in bright sunlight. And so plants must continuously synthesize chlorophyll to keep photosynthesizing. And it is very temperature sensitive. And that's kind of what happens here shortly. Now, the yellow and orange colors that you see in plants are called carotenoids. And they're there all the time. But the green chlorophyll covers them up. There's a lot more of the green stuff there than the carotenoids, and so they tend to look green. Chlorophyll absorbs red and blue light, whereas the carotenoids absorb bluish green and blue light. So they actually make the photosynthesis a little more efficient. They use a little bit more of the spectrum.
And how does weather affect the colors and the intensity of the colors?
Well, we'll get to that. I got to build this story here.
Now, when
the temperatures fall, what happens is the chlorophyll starts to break down. As I said before, it's very temperature sensitive. And so you start to see the carotenoids. You start to see the yellows and the oranges that were there all the time, but they were kind of covered up by the green. Now, typically you see that in hickory and ash and beech and birch. I was on the way up here today and I was driving down a road that was, I think, must have been all beech trees because it was just yellow on both sides, just crazy yellow. It was really beautiful. Now, the reds that we see are called by pigments called anthocyanins, and those are the things that give things like apples and blueberries and cherries their reddish colors. They only form when the temperature is dropped, though. So there's proteins that are in the sap, and they start to interact with the sugar. What's happening is as the leaves are starting to shut down, the plant starts to cut its loss, and it starts to disconnect itself from the leaves through a layer called the abscission layer. But photosynthesis is still going on in the leaves, and so sugar starts to build up in the leaves. And in some plants that have these anthocyanins, specifically, you know, dogwoods, oaks, and maples, they react with these proteins, and the proteins rather react with the excess sugar and turn red. And so that's why some plants turn red. Now, the intensity of the colors that you asked about, think about this. Cool weather destroys chlorophyll, and bright sunlight destroys chlorophyll and promotes anthocyanins. So dry, sunny days followed by cool, dry nights produce the most intense colors. And that's the forecast for Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday of next week. So I'm hoping, I don't think we're quite at our most intense color right now, but I'm hoping the colors are going to pop up a little bit here.
Pop up a little bit more. And because we've had sort of, because it's been sort of favorable weather recently, does that help with the longevity of the colors and
the rain that we've had over the last couple of days is definitely going to help this to extend a little while. It'll keep the leaves on the trees a little bit longer.
Well, now we know when we're driving around or walking outside and seeing all those beautiful trees changing color, we know why they do it.
It's beautiful, but there's some cool science behind it.
There's always cool science behind it.
This is true.
Thank you, Joe Johnson.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Cool Science Guy Joe Johnson. We'll take a break, and when we come back, a very special Moving Toward Health with Maggie Fitzpatrick. We have a special guest, and we'll tell you more next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Music from a musician's perspective. I'm Kathy Geary, and on Now and Then, we explore the artistry of the singer-songwriter. Now and then, Saturday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Tuesday, we hear from Maggie Fitzpatrick. She's the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is Moving Toward Health, and she joins us today. But today also, you've brought along a special guest, Maggie. And do you want to introduce your special guest here?
Sure, I can do that. Something I love about this area is that it's pretty small. Everyone's connected.
Let's run into somebody.
Yeah. So I got introduced to Ruth Bonapace, who's here with me today, and she just released a book called The Bulgarian Training Manual, and she was kind enough to send it to me, so I got to read it, and I thought it'd be fun to do a little joint segment today.
Yeah, and Ruth, good morning, and thanks for being here. And when I heard that the Bulgarian Training Manual was the name of your book, I got scared. But it's actually a comic novel, but there are actually Bulgarian training manuals out there. Can you tell folks a little bit about your idea for the Bulgarian Training Manual?
Yeah, just really summing it up. Years ago, I was at the gym, and a guy who's into bodybuilding, one of the trainers, saw me coming every day and that I was serious. And then he gave me all these photocopied pages and told me it was this Bulgarian manual, but not to show it to anybody. It was just for me. And I took it home, and it was like this guide to becoming a Olympic powerlifter. And it was so crazy.
That's why I was scared.
yeah, exactly. And I always thought it was very funny, and that maybe someday I'd write about it, because it was just so strange. But it was a true thing.
Yeah, and you did write about it, as I mentioned, a comic novel that tells the story of Tina in her quest to find her true parents and genes that fit. Well, tell us about the idea of this, and you know, how your background, as you mentioned, being in the gym, informed the story.
Well, basically, she starts off. It's almost, I realized after I wrote it, almost like a Wizard of Oz story. She's feeling very oppressed and whiny, and she's got all these problems, and wants to, you know, kind of escape. And her escape is really going to the gym. And she's not like really that serious. It's just, you know, you go on the bike, maybe she'll lose a couple of pounds and everything. And then through the book, she gets this manual, and then through that process, goes off and has this big adventure. And in the end, without being a spoiler, it comes back changed. And it reminds me in a way of in Oz, near the end, Glinda, the Good Witch of the North, tells her to tap the ruby slippers, and that will take her home. And they're like, well, why didn't you tell her this in the beginning? And it was like, well, she wouldn't have believed me. And it was like, bam, that was really what it is. It's like she had to go through this journey to discover that she's stronger than she knows, not so much her muscles, but her mentally, emotionally. And that's really the journey. But I wanted to make it funny and a takeoff on, you know, a lot of our pop culture and wellness craze that sometimes goes to the extreme.
Well, Maggie is here every Tuesday with her column, mm-hmm. Moving Toward Health. And that's one of the things we touch on a lot. In your columns have a theme about the mental part of all of this. And as Ruth is explaining with Tina in the gym, she's escaping, and the gym is this vehicle for escapism. And you know, we talk about how the gym gives you confidence.
Yeah, it definitely does. I loved that part of the story so much, because I do feel like it relates to most people's experience when it comes to going on a fitness journey, right? We use that word journey a lot, and it really is, because you don't know what you're in for, right? You just start with some random goal, probably weight loss, and then all of these things come out of it that you could have never predicted. And like you said, I love that Wizard of Oz reference, because you would have never believed what could happen at the end in the beginning. You know, you would never believe that. And so you would never be able to see how confident you could be, or how much you could change, or how much you could believe in yourself when you start, until you look back on it.
And you mentioned, Ruth, that you looked at this in terms of the different crazes in exercise and fitness and diet. And you kind of thought, could this be like a, you know, symbol of the next diet craze? Is that right? Is it sort of informing some of this?
Yes. Well, I actually knew somebody I worked with that lost a lot of weight. And I said, well, what did you do? And he said he was on the Subway diet. And he told me all he ate was Subway sandwiches. I thought he was like pulling my leg, you know. I was like, no.
No, and that was a thing. Yeah.
It was a thing. And there's all kinds of things that you think there's no way. So I was looking like if you were, you know, an obsessed bodybuilder wanting an edge over everyone else, what might you do? And then I actually was reading about St. Catherine of Siena and supposedly that she lived on communion wafers and it was a miracle for 7 years. And I was like, what if somebody actually latched onto that and tried it? I mean, so it, and it just, I thought it was very funny, but it also illustrated just how far-fetched some of these crazes are.
You delve into the idea of body image as well, and particularly by including some actual historical figures. Yeah. In the bodybuilding world, strong men and strong women. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, what I came to find was in my research for the book, there were women in the around the turn of like 1890s to 1920s who were very strong, very muscular, and but they were relegated to like freak shows because they were considered abnormal, and circuses, and they would have like shows where they would hold up a man on a platform and to show their strength, and the pictures of them are really quite beautiful because now we celebrate people like Serena Williams, and you know, having a fit body, toned, having muscle is not considered strange. It's considered not by everybody, unfortunately, but it's attainable. And back then, it was just considered weird.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because they've been pretty forgotten, these people.
Yeah. Another thing that you use for inspiration are actual people, other actual people and experiences, including people in your own family. Can you tell us about your grandmother and how your grandmother influenced parts of the story?
That is true. My grandmother liked to watch professional wrestling and boxing on TV. When I was a little kid, she had a black and white TV, if you could imagine. And I'd go there and she'd be watching these shows and drinking a beer. And I always thought that was kind of interesting because I came to realize like nobody else's grandmother did that. And so when I was writing my book, I did an exaggerated version of her who liked to drink beer. And she also lived in a city, my grandmother, and she was like, you know, kind of a lower middle class kind of neighborhood. And, but I decided, well, what if this grandmother was really feisty? And then I went on from there, you know? And so she, I had this like really feisty grandma who influences the narrator.
There's nothing like a feisty grandma in real life and in literature.
Yeah.
Maggie, of course, we want to mention in the column, Moving Toward Health is out in the Sullivan County Democrat today. It's also at SC Democrat Online. Your subject today is improving exercise consistency. I don't know. Can we weave these two things together?
Probably. Yeah. We're pretty good at that.
I think so. But I mean, in the terms of like just why you're going to the gym and some of the themes that Ruth touches on in her book, The Bulgarian Training Manual.
Yeah. So this week I was writing about just two factors that really play into a training program, which actually, if you go read the book, you'll learn all about the charts in the Bulgarian Training Manual and all the different type of workouts that you can do, which kind of plays into this, no matter how extreme you want to take it, right? But two factors that are really important to consider are intensity of your training and duration of your training, right? And so it is really easy to fall into the trap of believing that intensity and duration, so like how hard your workout is and how long it is, need to be maximized all the time, right? If I don't go to the gym for a very long time and work out as hard as possible, it doesn't count. It's really easy to fall into that mindset where we really want to actually manipulate those factors and see, maybe how could I get the best results possible with lower intensity, with less time spent exercising, right? And we want to make sure we're not falling into this trap of just trying to push them both to the max as much as possible. So that's just something that we want to consider because it will help us with consistency, because when we push those too far, we end up burning out, falling off track, right? It's really hard to keep up with. So we want to make sure we're not doing that. And that will help us with, you know, making sure that we are exercising consistently over longer periods of time.
Well, and Ruth, and let me try to tie this together. Ruth writes about how or says that, you know, as you personally go to the gym, not just as an escape, but as a way of keeping your quality of life well, being well as you get older.
Yeah, exactly. I want to be as strong as I can for as long as I can to be able to walk with confidence and lift packages, and becomes more and more important. And also weight training. It doesn't have to be extreme weight training. Just any weight training is good to keep our bones strong, especially women. It helps to guard against advancing osteoporosis. And real quick, like I started going to the gym consistently. I was interested when you said consistency, because I would kind of go on it once in a while. And then it was a tough period of my life when I was actually getting a divorce, and I was feeling pretty low. And I started going to the gym like every day at lunchtime. And I found that as the more I went, I was not only feeling a little stronger, and I noticed I just was feeling mentally stronger as well. And I felt really, it just improved my whole mental outlook. And then people started noticing, like somebody said, do you play tennis? And I was like, no, I don't play tennis, but it's because my arms are toned. And yeah. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, it's making like this difference, but it's the consistency, like going like every day at lunchtime. I wasn't doing anything extreme, but it was showing. It had results.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't have to be a Bulgarian Olympian to get those results, I think is the message we're taking away too.
You don't have to.
You don't have to, but you can move toward health. Maggie Fitzpatrick is the columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is Moving Toward Health. It's out today on newsstands or online, scdemocratonline.com. And Ruth Bonifaz is the author of the Bulgarian Training Manual, out now. Thank you guys so much. This was fun and special. So we appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, a teen podcasting idea that involves Radio Catskill and the Western Sullivan Public Library. We'll find out more after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cooked breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl, and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Regular listeners of Radio Catskill will know our next guest as the host of Liberation Station, which airs Saturday nights at 7. But she's also the new youth programs coordinator at the Western Sullivan Public Library. It's Callison Stratton, and she's here to tell us about a big idea to engage teens in our community.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Congratulations on your new role.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been such a wonderful place to be. And I was a clerk before I was the youth programmer, so it's just a wonderful community.
Everybody loves a library. Thank you.
We all love the library.
So let's talk about this idea. It's a teen podcasting program.
Yes.
And we're going to partner with the Western Sullivan Public Library here at Radio Catskill. Let's tell folks about it and how'd you came up to this idea?
So we came up with this idea. It's a podcasting for teens. It's starting in November. It's going to be meeting on Saturdays at the Tustin Keshecton branch in Narrowsburg, Saturday mornings. And we came up with the idea because we really, when I started in the position, really wanted to expand our outreach to teens. We have a lot of wonderful programs for pre-K and for school-aged kids, but we sort of saw a big sort of hole in the community programming for teens. And I think that's been a really big collective community concern, is finding things for our teens and tweens to do after school and on the weekends and to keep them engaged. And so we thought, what better way than to help them find their own voice through a podcasting program?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there was the old idiom of like, there's nothing for teens to do here in this area.
Right.
Some may still feel that way, but now there's this pull of the internet and social media and all of those things where they're living there, and it's harder to engage in a, you know, a library level or even when we look at engaging folks to, you know, listen to the radio, we've had kids come over and take a tour and they're like, what's the radio? What is that?
Right. What is the radio? I know. And I grew up listening to public radio and I love podcasts. And I, as a host of a radio show myself here on Radio Catskill, I felt that it was something that, you know, I could bring my specific skill set to, but also, you know, I think that I've always felt really empowered to, you know, share my voice through the radio. And that's why it felt like a really great partnership to do a podcasting, which is something that kids can share in any way. You know, they can share it on Spotify. You can watch podcasts on any platform, listen to podcasts on any platform, but then to also partner with WJFF and, to be able to offer an opportunity for those podcasts that they're going to be producing during this program to then be broadcast on air.
Yep. And you're meeting teens at their level. Like they're engaged with their phone or their computer. And so podcasting naturally layers over that. So they're going to have a better understanding of it perhaps and be more engaged.
Absolutely. And it's going to be a 6-week program. Like I said, it's going to be meeting on Saturdays. It's a pretty low commitment, you know, it's like 1 hour a week, but then they'll get to take the tools that they learn in the workshop home with them. And it's going to be very much, like you said, meeting them at their level, using tools that they're going to already have at their disposal, their phones to do interviews or just to record on their own. We've also got Chris Orbach has agreed to participate, one of our,
Yes, we know Chris. You'll hear his voice here too sometimes doing the IDs or
exactly. And he's going to walk promos through the kids during a Finding Your Voice workshop, will help, you know, sort of just like gaining confidence in front of a microphone.
Well, and he is a, you know, voiceover artist. He exactly. does that. And so to have a professional in your backyard showing you how to do that, that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, if the folks listening who know a teen that might want to get involved, where can they get more information? Because teens that are listening should be in school.
Yes. Teens, if you're listening, get back to class. Parents, if you're listening, you can contact me, Callison, at wspl.children's@gmail.com. That's my email address for the children's programming. And you can also register. The link to register is live on our website. You can visit the calendar at wsplonline.org. And that's where you can find us. And yeah, like I said, it's live. You can already register, but there are limited spaces. Mm-hmm. We just sort of launched the program. So now is the opportunity to get your kids signed up and help them find their voice and use all of the library's resources. We are a free resource for everybody. We offer so many things. And this is just one of many things that people can get.
Quickly, what are some of the things you're working on in terms of youth programming? I know you just started, but what are some other ideas you got?
We've already kind of gotten started with, we sort of hit the ground running. We had a really successful summer program, but I do also offer a kids playgroup. We meet 3 times a month. We rotate between the 3 branches in Narrowsburg, Jeffersonville, and Calicoon. And that's on Wednesdays at 10:15 in the morning. And that's also, you can visit our calendar to sign up for that, but you can also drop in, and that's for kids under the age of 3. It's sort of a playgroup environment for families and little kids to connect. And I bring my guitar and we sing and we play. It's very fun.
That's very cool.
We also do story time. That's usually on Fridays, and that's at Narrowsburg or in Calicoon. Again, visit the calendar. And we also are offering another teen program on Wednesdays in Narrowsburg called Crafter School. And we've been collaborating with the Tustin Youth Club for a long time, and they offer a program for the younger kids. And so then the kids who are 12 and up can hop off the school bus and just come over to the library. And I've got a lot of like crafting activities for them. And then once a month, we do Cartooning Club as well.
Oh my gosh, this sounds like fun. I wish I was a teen.
Yeah, right?
Callison Stratton with the Western Sullivan Public Library. There's more information at wsplonline.org. And don't forget, listen to Liberation Station every Saturday night at 7, or you can stream it live at wjffradio.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, the CBS News Vice Presidential Debate simulcast is tonight here at 9. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania. offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, cloudy, a high of 66. Mostly cloudy tonight, 52. Tomorrow looks like clouds, slightly cooler, high of 60, maybe a shower, but warming up Thursday and Friday, high near 70. On Points next, it's 11 o'clock.